Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Kopaki, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 21, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar today, and we are here on our first case that is A210437 and A210449. In the matter of the welfare of the child of VRR and MAH. Counsel, I'm going to ask that you mute your microphone when you're not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Your Honor, this is Joshua Knuckles. I'm representing Marshall Holmes in his appeal. In this case, on October 24th, 2019, a petition to terminate parental rights was filed. This case originated with the CHIPS action that began in late 2018 after the birth of the child, the subject child in this matter.
Was your client part of the CHIPS action?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
This
Mr. Nichols, because before you go further, I just would like to clarify, are you making oral argument on behalf of both parents? Is Ms. Walker planning to argue on behalf of the other appellant?
Your Honor, I'm making oral arguments on behalf of my client, Marshall Holmes. I'm not aware of the status of Ms. Walker regarding the mother. I did see that she filed a brief. I'm not sure what her status was on attending oral arguments.
It appears that she's a participant in the Zoom. Perhaps I should have addressed this before argument began, and I apologize, Judge Frisch, for interrupting proceedings. But I just wanted to understand Mr. Knuckles' argument before he began. But
well, thank you, Your Honor. This a permanency petition. After the permanency petition was filed. In October of 2019, the trial was finalized February 25th of 2021, over a year after that petition was finalized. Regarding the case plan, the trial court found that the father had made some progress regarding chemical use. That wasn't so much of an issue. The primary issue for the trial court was visitation. Now, that being said, the trial court did seem to find that in the early part stages of the case, back in June of 2020, that the father had good visitation, a visitation that was described as going well. The father was described as having his visits basically being extremely warm and positive. So several witnesses at trial were testifying to this. Now, my primary argument in this matter is that the trial court didn't properly follow the statutory criteria in finding that one, that the father neglected his child in foster care, two, that the father refused or was unable to comply with his parental duties. And so those would be the two bases for a termination of parental rights. And then ultimately that Wadena County failed to make reasonable efforts and that such a termination would be in the best interest of the child. Now, regarding neglect of the child in foster care, that allegation, we have 260C.007 subdivision 24 describes basically what neglect in foster care means, what it is. But then to come to that conclusion, the statute in 260C.163 subdivision 9 basically lays out seven factors for the court to go through in making such a determination. The statute says that the court shall consider those factors in its conclusions of law.
I noticed that the trial court didn't make any finding on those factors, did it?
No, Your Honor. And
is there a requirement that it make findings on those? Or is that simply assigning the item that we can look at the record and see whether or not the findings that were made are sufficient.
And the statute says the court shall consider those factors. So it shall consider them in making its findings. And so basically we have to trace back from the findings themselves to what they're basing that upon in their findings of fact. And they do that in the conclusions of law. The court does that in the conclusions of law and basically identifies continued involvement in crimes connected to use of controlled substances, failure to meet reasonable expectations with regard to visiting the child. And I think primarily this idea that the father's not visited the child in the last 9 months from the date of that trial or the date of that order.
Mr. Knuckles, I'm going to stop you. I'm going to ask the marshal to stop the clock for just a moment. I've been alerted that Ms. Walker does intend to argue on behalf of mom, and it appears as though the parties did not reach an agreement on splitting their time this morning for primary argument. So Mr. Knuckles, I'm going to split the time for you. So I'm going to ask you to conclude finish your argument with 7 minutes remaining, and then we'll turn it over to Ms. Walker so that she can make an argument on behalf of her client. And then we can deal with the rebuttal, if any, after that. All right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any problem with that, counsel?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Walker, I'm going to have your... Ms. Walker, okay. Any objection to that splitting of time there?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll have the marshal restart the clock at 10:07. Go ahead, Mr. Knuckles.
And specifically within those factors listed that the court should be evaluating, I'd point to factor 3, where the time frame that the court should be looking at is the 3 months preceding the filing of the petition. And the trial court didn't weigh in on the 3 months prior to the filing of the petition as its basis for making that statement regarding missing 40% of the visits, having no visitation for 9 months. The time frame that the trial court should be looking at is the 3 months prior to the filing of the petition, and that would be stretching back to July of 2019. That's when many of these commendations that the court did note regarding warm and positive visitation, as well as unsupervised visitation, took effect. And so the failure to make that assessment, instead looking at basically a year later when kind of a breakdown in communication, a breakdown in relationship between the father and social services, basically prevented from the sort of ongoing visitation. And I think the reason for the statute to be focused on the 3 months prior to the filing of the permanency petition is connected what generally happens when social services goes from being focused on reunifying the children to you and suddenly is viewed as this adversary who's basically wanting to take everything away, who's basically seeking to terminate any rights you have regarding the children. So that 3 month period, I think, is important to frame the analysis regarding visitation. So if we're going to make findings that the father failed to perform his parental duties, or that he's neglected the children in foster care, it's got to be rooted back in that timely portion of the case. And when we're looking at the case from October throughout the next year, stretching out to trial to February of 2021, there were so many intervening factors. There was the COVID shutdown. There was, all through that time, this looming termination of parental rights petition that really affected visitation. And so the failure to really evaluate that statutory factor, basically 3 in 260C.163 subdivision 9, I think is fatal to the court's decision and needs to be addressed.
Is there any case law that supports your interpretation of that requirement?
Not that I could find, Your Honor, as tailored to these facts. And I believe my time is up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Knuckles. You'll have some additional time for rebuttal. Ms. Walker?
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I misspoke earlier. I do have some frustration over the fact that both Mr. Knuckles and my client's time are pinched together because we are two separate appellants with two separate sets of issues. And I need to note that for the record. I need to note also that Mr. Knuckles has put forth a very strong brief regarding the situation at hand. Our clients were, one of the biggest issues in our case is that, and I'm going to be very brief because I'm assuming you've read our briefs, is that that there needs to be reasonable efforts for the situation. We do not have what's qualified as reasonable efforts for the situation. And in this case, the judge wanes on a lot in his findings about how this case has gone on and there were reasonable efforts that were made. However, what are reasonable efforts in a COVID situation where people were having difficulties having in-person therapy or in-person, even in-person issue as to alcohol abuse or methamphetamine abuse or what that meant. And there is plenty of issues with this past COVID-19 and reasonable efforts of what that meant, but there's nothing dictated by law. And however the judge waxes and wanes about how that was an implication and not, I don't agree with the judge's ability to say it was a benefit to our clients only because our clients could not seek those rehabilitation efforts and the availability of services as under 260C007 subdivision 2 sub 3, the availability of services. What did that look like? Or what else could they have offered? Or what else could they have done? And also, I really want to enforce what Mr. Knuckles had said is that they did not take a hindsight look at, in filing the petition, what had visitation looked like? Where was the sobriety of the people at the time prior to the petition being filed? It seems like everything fell apart after the petition was filed and COVID hit. Now the court makes light of the situation that things were just closed down or things were shut down for a few short months. However, they weren't just shut down for a few short months. There was a backup log and for goodness sakes, even courts. We're not seeing people in person for civil lawsuits and things like this. So as to reasonable efforts, I make an argument in my brief as to reasonable efforts. And as to reasonable efforts, I put in my brief, you know, there was no cell phone offered to my client. There was, they talk about the other point in my brief that maybe I did not succinctly make enough was there was a lot of I don't knows in the testimony of the social service agents, as well as the guardian litems. That's very frustrating. It was already a difficult time. We had COVID. Services weren't often offered, or they were offered only during Zoom. But if you couldn't get to Zoom, what was your option? That was never discussed. That was never pointed out. And my client, you know, was she the greatest at showing up for her appointments? No. But was that due to poverty? Was that due to the situation she was living in? No. She couldn't be at her home anymore where she used to live, but they never viewed her home. They never offered her a consistent schedule. They kept moving where she could have visitations, regardless of whether or not that location of visitation was acceptable to her or easy for her to get to. And they were so stagnant in offering even her hair follicle test. Yes, it took her a few times to get there, but could they have taken a hair follicle test from somewhere else on her body? Of course they could. There are plenty of other offered services and accepted across Minnesota. And those were not accepted. It was only because it was a standard of like, oh, we just don't do it that way. So I'm frustrated with the very fact that, you know, my client wasn't quite sure. She had three social workers, two guardian ad litem, and everybody telling her a different story. We all know these are very, very tough cases. We know COVID was tough. So between what was reasonable for the situation, I believe the reasonable standard that is being applied by this particular judge is a standard that is only applicable to what was reasonable outside of this dimension. And that was played unfairly to my client. And I don't believe that it's good enough, because any findings you have must be the findings that's reasonable to the situation. That's how the law is written. And that was not addressed. And there is, what does that mean? Does that mean reasonable to a situation so long as there is not a pandemic? Reasonable to the situation so long as you don't have three social workers and two guardian ad litems, because you live in small town America, the decision is made differently for you because of this particular upbringing or outrising. In addition, and I'm sorry, I'm going through my notes here. In addition, I believe that Mr. Knuckles' arguments, which are very solid, how the court should consider these options. Just because the court wrote a 42-page document, you know how many times that document was amended after the court wrote it? Four, as far as I know. And why was the court amending it? I don't know why the court was amending it, but it kept being amended. So it was a moving target for us to even write an appeals for, because we weren't alerted to what was specifically being amended. So we would have to like nail through a 42-page document or referencing what in the world was going on. That is a frustrating situation for attorneys on a court of appeals to be in. And where does, when the whole system is shut down, where does a person in poverty need to be in a situation like this? I'm sorry, my time's up.
All right, thank you, Ms. Walker. You'll have some additional time for rebuttal if you choose to use it, all right?
Again, I want to refresh my argument that when you have two appellants, they should each get 15 minutes.
Yeah, we have some procedures that those are supposed to be, those issues are supposed to be decided before the oral argument begins. Okay, Mr. Percy, go ahead, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Scott Hersey, and I represent the respondent, the County of Wadena, in this appeal. The sole issue raised by each appellant is the claim that the district court findings were insufficient to support its termination order as to each parent. For the appellant mother, the court found four different statutory bases for termination under 260C.301, subdivision 1B, 2, 4, 5, and 8. And for the father, the court found two statutory bases, subdivision 1B, 2, and 8. Both by the applicable statutes and by the case law, only one statutory basis is necessary to support a termination order. I would submit to the court that the district court's 41-page findings and order support its termination order on each statutory basis for each of the parents. For each parent, the visitation became more erratic over time, with more no-shows and more cancellations, as well as late arrivals and early departures. For each parent, the visitation finally stopped during the summer of 2020. And at the time of the termination order, which was March 18th, the amended termination order, March 18th of 2021, mother had not visited in 6 months and father had not visited in 9 months. And Mr. Rousling.
Counsel, do you have a view as to which is the strongest statutory grounds for termination? One, as to the mother, and two, as to the father?
As to the mother, it would seem that ground four probably, in my view, is the strongest, although I do believe that they are all supported by the district court's extensive findings, that she was palpably unfit to provide proper parenting for this child. And as to the father, I would submit 1B2, although I believe both grounds do apply, that he neglected to comply with the duties required by the parent-child relationship. And
thank you.
In that regard, I would point out that Mr. Rousling, one of the social workers, estimated that mother missed about 45% of her scheduled visits, father missed about 40%. And as an example, in June of 2020, visitations, in-person visitations, were ordered to be resumed by the district court. There were 12 visits scheduled for the father. He made only two. In July of 2020, mother had 9 scheduled visits, but again, she made only two. And thereafter, both of them simply fell off the page as far as any visitation.
Do you want to respond to the appellant's argument about the trial court's lack of focusing on the 3 months before the action?
Yes, thank you, Judge. I understand Mr. Knuckles' argument, but I would point out that the extensive findings by the district court, and it made a whole section as to mother's visitation and a whole section as to father's visitation, covered the entire time of not only the CHIPS case, but even the time of the pendency of the termination case. And the judge made this specific finding as to father that even before the filing of the termination petition, he was missing an unacceptable number of visits. And additionally, he was showing up late and leaving early, and that became the pattern of the mother as well. And I believe the statute talks in terms of examining the entire time frame up to the time of the judge's order and the trial. And I think the trial court properly did so. Further, I would point out that the trial court not only focused on visitation, but it focused on both parents' chemical problems. Each parent had numerous positive for chemicals and insufficient samples, particularly, which they had been warned by the social workers, were considered positive UAs. Mother had tests that were positive for meth 7 times, positive for alcohol 1 time, and had 17 insufficient samples, 2 of which had positive preliminary results. Even though she was ordered by the district court to get a hair follicle drug test to test for use of methamphetamine, she missed 3 of those visits. When she finally showed up, she refused to allow head hair to be taken, which was the standard method of conducting that particular test. Father also had problems with his testing, although Mr. Rouselang testified that it was difficult to get tests out of father because it was so hard to get a hold of him. In fact, during part of the proceeding, father ended up, when he couldn't get a hold of the father, driving over to his apartment and leaving notes on the door of father. And father admitted in his testimony that he did in fact receive those notes. Father tested positive for alcohol in February 2019. He was arrested for felony possession of drugs in May of 2019. And he already had a felony drug pending from prior to the filing of the CHIPS case. He tested positive for methamphetamine and MDMA, another controlled substance, in June of 2020. And he admitted in January of 2021 to Ms. Washington, one of the social workers, that he regularly used marijuana. And when he had a contact with the police also in January of 2021, he told him he probably would be testing positive for marijuana because he got car rides from people who smoke marijuana, although ultimately the test was clean on that occasion. Both parents also underwent diagnostic assessments, which is another term for psychological evaluations, and both assessments recommended mental health treatment, and neither parent followed through with any of the visits or canceled the visits. The only visits they made were the original visits to get those diagnostic assessments, and the trial court specifically relied on those facts and indicated that the parents' compliance with the psychologicals and the diagnostic assessments were inadequate. The court cited in his findings that—
Can you remind me, when the child was taken away from the mother's care by the county and there was a hearing, did that hearing adjudicate the father as being neglectful of the child?
Not initially, because of the fact, I don't believe, to the best of my recollection, the petition, CHIPS petition was filed. Father had not yet been adjudicated. That was filed, I believe, in December of 2018. In February of 2019, just a few months later, father was adjudicated. And then there was a plan, adjudicated the father. And then there was an out-of-home placement plan done as to him as well.
Mr. Hersey?
Yes.
With respect to the statutory ground of refused or neglected to comply with statutory duties inherent in the parent and child relationship, is it appropriate for a district court to look at evidence of the party's conduct after the out-of-home placement? Or is that statutory ground intended to apply only to the time period when the child is in the parent's custody and care?
Well, I would suggest to the court that that is intended to cover the whole situation, because the entire purpose of an out-of-home placement plan is to list the various areas where the parent's parenting and behavior has been deficient and problematic for raising the child. And then also what is put in the plan are the specific steps to correct those deficiencies. And those are the things that in a CHIPS case, many times can be addressed and are addressed, and the parents then recover custody of the child and the CHIPS petition is dismissed. But I would submit that it is appropriate to look at the entire time frame once the CHIPS petition is filed and look at the progress. If the parent makes sufficient progress on the plan, then the child will be returned to the parent's custody. But
let me follow up a bit, because that statute refers to the duty to provide the child with necessary food, clothing, shelter, education, and other care and control necessary for the child's physical, mental, and emotional health and development. It seems like if a child is in foster care in a foster home and the parent has limited visitation opportunities, it's impossible for the parent to provide all of those things. It seems like the more appropriate statutory ground would be neglected and in foster care.
Well, that was another ground on which the trial court terminated father's rights. But I would suggest in this case, if one looks at the district court's findings, the district court lists all the visitations that were made, and it lists all the visitations that were missed or that had to be canceled because parents arrived late or left early. But in any event, I would submit under the case that I cited in my brief in the matter of the welfare of AD, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that as it relates to the many factors, the seven factors dealing with neglected and in foster care listed in 260C.163, it's not necessary for the trial court to address and make findings on each one of those. As long as its findings show that those statutory factors exist, that is sufficient. And that's what the trial court did here. I would submit that its findings are thorough and cover each one of those. And I described in my brief the various factors that the judge considered in his findings that showed that each of these seven factors in 163 existed. But again, I would point out that even without COVID, the district court said that both parents' attitude that they did not need chemical dependency treatment and they did not need any mental health treatment despite assessments otherwise by professionals would have given the same result despite the existence of COVID. Each of mother's Rule 25s indicated she needed inpatient chemical dependency treatment. She tried twice during the course of the CHIPS and termination. Both times she failed and left without completing the programs, and both times she used meth while in the program. Father himself had a Rule 25 that was part of his out-of-home placement plan, and that indicated he should have either inpatient or outpatient treatment. He did not go through either of those. Further, as indicated, both parents had extensive testings and either had many insufficient samples or tested positive, or in the mother's case, many times didn't even show up for it. And the court also relied on the father's history of crimes. And it is true, as Mr. Knuckles pointed out, that some of those crimes predated the filing of the CHIPS petition. But father was arrested in May of 2019 during the CHIPS petition for felony drug possession, which was a concern of the court. He was also arrested in September of 2019 for a felony harassment restraining order violation. And that is a matter of some concern because the allegations in the petition, which the judge had in evidence, alleged two assaults against his girlfriend's children. And in that regard, his past history seems to be relevant because he had 8 domestic or fifth degree assault convictions and a disorderly conduct conviction, all acts of violence. And arguably, mother forfeited any argument that she was found to be palpably unfit to be a party to the parent-child relationship under 260C.301 subdivision 1B4 because she did not address that in her brief. And I cited the authority in my brief to indicate that constitutes a forfeiture of that argument. So that alone should be sufficient to uphold the termination as to the mother. Now, the Minnesota Department of Human Services recommends moving for permanency after 11 months. In fact, it has a 6-month period for children under the age of 8. And these parents had over twice that amount. It was 818 days as of the date of Mary Weaver's testimony at the end of the trial in February of 2021, and she was the guardian ad litem. So there was ample time for these parents to accomplish their plans. And instead of progressing on their plans, the evidence showed that they regressed over time. And the district court also addressed the best interests of the child and found that it would be in the best interests of the child to terminate both parental rights and place the children for adoption with the maternal grandparents and with the child's half-brother. And the court included in its findings how well that placement was going and how the child was being nurtured and flourishing in that environment. I would submit that the COVID pandemic that did stop visitation for a period of time from sometime in March to very early June was a relatively short period of time compared to the 818 days that the parties had to try and accomplish their plans. And the court specifically indicated that during that period, it was not going to hold the parents' progress or lack of progress against the parents. I would submit that a remand to the district court for a new out-of-home placement plan, as suggested by the mother, would be an exercise in futility. The plan would be essentially the same for each parent because the same parenting deficiencies, including chemical dependency, mental health, and failure to follow through with visitation, still exists, and those are untreated and unresolved. In addition, simply reinstating the same plan would defeat the statutory requirements for the permanency.
Counsel, your time has expired, all right? Thank you very much. Mr. Nichols and Ms. Walker, we'll split your rebuttal time. We'll start with you, Mr. Nichols. Go ahead, sir.
Your Honor, I point to page 13 and 14 of the trial court order, finding of fact 108 and 109. In 108, there's about 17 listed missed or canceled visits with the child by the father. And as you can see, almost 15 of those 17 occurred November 1st through March 9th of 2020. That means that only 2 of those were prior to the termination of parental rights petition being filed. And as the judge noted on both of those, there were legitimate reasons for those missed visits. One was a back pain issue. The other was foster parents failing to respond to inquiries by the father. Regarding Minnesota statute 260C.301 subdivision 1B2, I would note that the trial court basically found by clear and convincing evidence that the father substantially, continuously, or repeatedly refused or neglected to comply with the duties imposed upon that parent by the parent and child relationship. But as to the statutory reasons for that, and the statute outlines that it's food, clothing, shelter, education, care and control is necessary for the child's physical, mental, or emotional health and development, the court doesn't really clue us in on the reason why that finding was made. Again, it points to missing an unacceptable number of visits. It doesn't give us any idea what acceptable number of visits would look like. And I think that's important because we really don't have an idea of what would be an acceptable number of visits. what time period is being looked at. And again, it's oriented again on the last 9 months or so of the case prior to trial. And so I think this is a clear problem with the trial court's use of this factor. And if this is the strongest basis for it, I think it fails.
All right, thank you, Mr. Knuckles. Ms. Walker? You're muted, ma'am.
I agree with Mr. Knuckles that there's just simply not enough detail, especially when we're talking about somebody who has missed visits, but they didn't state the duration or why the visits were missed. Did she just not show up? Did she miss a car ride? Was there a given reason for any visit that was missed? Also, with the number of UAs, this whole idea of presumption, they state that my client provided urine, but the whole idea that she didn't provide enough urine. And then also the state stated that that she had been found using meth, that in her last treatment facility, she was not found at all for using meth. There was one instance where she may have had trace alcohol in her system, but she was not using meth. And she believed that she was in fact following their program and what they needed. Again, I state that in order to make any analysis under any of the subdivisions, reasonable efforts by the county, as well as best interest of the children, needed to be taken into analysis. So in the statute dealing with that, the mother was found to be palpably unfit. I do not, as I argued throughout my brief, I do not believe that reasonable efforts were necessarily provided. Reasonable services were provided to my client, as well as they needed to make the same findings under the other statutes of why a client would be unfit. And the court failed to make that analysis. I will agree. The court went through a painstaking section by section, 41 page order, but it was still not substantial enough to make the finding that my client was reasonably unfit, nor to make the finding under the rest of the statutes they tried to use against against my client for saying that she needed to not have custody of her children. And if you look at her history, I mean, there was constant comments like the visits were going really well, everything was great. And then her last visit, there was one for a use of alcohol, which she had admitted, but there was nothing for methamphetamines. But nothing was done to continue between the county and my client communication. There was nothing that showed that they even attempted to communicate with my client, much less offer her a phone. And opposing counsel's argument is that, oh, she was able to finally get one and figure out a way. That's not a reasonable effort to reasonably find a phone and figure out a way. That is the effort upon the county to make sure that she has the ability to communicate with social services, especially in a poverty situation when they know that she was not highly employed, especially during a time of pandemic. That's what I'm talking about. What are reasonable efforts during a time of pandemic when a lot of jobs are not available to people living in small town Minnesota? This is one of those issues. Does she need to go and beg for a phone, or is it just enough for her to say, I can't keep a phone policy going? Does she even know that that's something that the county can provide her? They didn't testify as to that was provided to her. And in fact, there was specific testimony about, I don't know. And a lot of the social workers and guardian ad litem replied instead, I don't know, I don't recall. And they relied—
Ms. Walker, I've allowed you to continue your argument well past the expiration of time. If you just want to sum up quickly, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think this needs to be put back to the district county and an additional case plan made, because this is about a family. This is not about somebody committing a crime necessarily. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone. The matter is submitted and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.